Sunday Night Science.
As the bushfire season continues, I thought it might be worth exploring just how science is helping with the blazes across large parts of Australia. And ANU astrophysicist Dr. Brad Tucker is with me to talk about that and other developments in the world of space and technology. Hello there, Brad.
How's it going?
Well, how are satellites being used for bushfires?
Look, it's an interesting thing because it's one of these things that we don't necessarily think about. But, especially in the past couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of imagery of the impact of satellites. We've seen the smoke plumes. We've seen the smoke going over the ocean. We've even seen images kind of where it looks like Australia is glowing. And these are actually all different satellite techniques that are actually used in the whole, I would say, the whole process of fighting a bushfire. There's things to detect it. There's things to monitor it. There are satellites to predict it. And then there's satellites to view the consequence of it. And, you know, it's a really big part. It's not obviously the only part, but it's one of those things that sometimes it's easy to forget just how dependent in a place like Australia. We need that view from space to actually understand the nature, essentially, of the bushfire.
How can how quickly can satellites detect hotspots?
So there was a program launched in 2002, and this was called the Sentinel program, which is now managed by Geoscience Australia. And so the idea here was it was a satellite that looked in the infrared. So a lot of the looks are in what we call the infrared color. So if you think like night vision or cricket vision almost, well, the idea is you can kind of see through the smoke and you can detect areas that are literally hotter, that are glowing more in higher energies or higher temperatures. And so the Sentinel satellite passes over essentially twice a day, in the morning nominally and the evening nominally, and you can detect what they're looking for, a hotspot. So it's not just necessarily flames, but you're detecting areas potentially of higher temperature and therefore higher friction, maybe a very early stage of a bushfire. You can also see where on the fire front there's more activity and less activity. And this directly helps not only potential predictions of where fires are going, but as the fire is going now, where can you deploy or not more assets as one of the tools you can do. And it's the only way you can do it is with these views of satellites. And more recently, the ACT has had a helicopter that's had this infrared technology that maybe people have seen it being used. Well, we've been doing this with satellites for 15 years now, and it's been a direct tool and as a direct consequence, actually, of the 2002 fires in New South Wales and the ACT before the 2003 fires in Canberra, that was actually thought about this.
And I guess satellite technology is improving every day, and it will only help more down the track.
Yeah, because a lot of it is now not only detecting hotspots, but trying to do things like measuring the fuel load. So when we're talking about what is the moisture content of these areas, you know, a lot of the areas in the terrain people can't get to, right? So the only way you can see it is with a very large view. So that has to come from above. And some of this can be planes, but planes are also dependent on the weather and the winds and used for other purposes. So a satellite gives you a nice clear view. And so there's been a big push recently to increasing this activity, not only as the technology improves, but trying to use this in better ways to fight and aid fires, and not only knowing what's happening, but where the fire is going and doing some modeling about where the most likelihood the fire is going to be growing. And I think this fire season really in particular, we've seen those maps released by the New South Wales Rural Fire Service and other departments and states where you can kind of see where the fire might be moving. A lot of that is based on satellite data and knowing where the most likelihood of fuel is going to be burnt. And so one of the big things the space agency is looking at and groups in Australia are looking at is how can we increase this capability? You know, this is exactly what we talk about with being in kind of independent space nation. What can we do to observe the Earth to help us not only for bushfire fighting, but drought mitigation and other things? If you want to see Australia as a whole, you have to do it from space.
Yeah, those fire prediction maps have been absolutely crucial in this past season so far.
It really has. I mean, this is a direct tool that allows people to get out of harm's way, escape. And the more accurate they are, the better the resources can be deployed, the better people can be informed. It just trickles down to being an asset. And I think this is the thing to think about with space. You know, I love talking about all the cool things that we do, but space is also a very critical part of our infrastructure. And the reason the Australian government and groups in Australia said we need a space agency is we just weren't doing this infrastructure ourselves. And for a long time, we've been dependent on other countries. And it's kind of silly to think that. Imagine any other part of fighting a bushfire being solely reliant on overseas countries. I mean, that's just kind of, you would have people scratching their head saying, what are you doing? But that's what we've been doing a long time with our satellite imagery. And so as we grow the space agency and the space community here, it's making it more independent to just focus on Australia. So instead of two images per day, maybe we can get that up to an image an hour or an image every half hour, which can directly aid into the rapid development and the rapid feeding of information into what's happening with these fires.
This is Nightlife, and Dr. Brad Tucker is with me talking space and technology. Now, SpaceX is launching another 60 Starlink satellites, Brad. What are the satellites for, firstly?
So Starlink is an ambitious project to essentially provide global satellite internet. And again, it was just kind of what we were talking about. You know, as satellites orbit, they go around the Earth and they take about 90 minutes or so in low Earth orbit to do a loop, which means you're never covering one part of the Earth at the same time. This is how it stays in orbit. So there's been a big push in the community, and Starlink is a big part of this, to instead of saying let's just build one satellite, well, let's build a ring or a constellation of satellites. So as all of those satellites orbit, you're still observing that same part of the ground, just with a different satellite. So Starlink wants to put potentially upwards of 30,000 satellites in orbit to actually provide essentially a global internet network via satellite, so that you can log on to the internet anywhere in the world. Doesn't matter if you're in the middle of Australia or the ocean, you can log on to this and actually get fairly high-speed internet via satellite.
That's a lot of satellites in the air, right? What are some of the issues surrounding that many satellites in space?
Look, it is a lot. And this is where we're starting to see the issues. I for one think trying to do these sorts of things is a good idea. I think trying to aid in providing, again, this crucial infrastructure into areas that are more remote. You know, to put this in the scale, with 8 launches, so every launch SpaceX puts up is about 60 satellites. So in their first batch of about 400 to 600, they will achieve the same rate of data downloads and speeds as the NBN, and it will be $2 billion cheaper. And, you know, I'm not trying to make a jab at the NBN here, but this is just showing that you can do things quite cheaply now in space, and this is a direct prod of it. And so naturally you say, all right, well, let's just put thousands and tens of thousands of them, and we can have pretty cheap global internet. Kind of a good idea, except those satellites then are in the way. Right. You know, if satellites are swarming the Earth, you know, it's kind of like being an Australian, having flies swarm in your face. If you have so many of them, well, they're in your face. And one thing satellites do is they reflect sunlight. Most famous cases, sometimes you'll see the International Space Station passing overhead. It's a very bright object and you see it as this very bright dot going across the sky. Very nice to look at. But now imagine 40,000 of those constantly swarming around the Earth. There is a worry that you would actually start to lose the nighttime sky because you have so many satellites constantly going above you, reflecting sunlight, that you can't actually see space.
Wow.
And we're starting to see a bit of this actually happening. So in a lot of our telescopes, when we're looking into space for astronomy or cool things or monitoring for asteroids that may come near the Earth, you see streaks of satellites going through. Now, in the past 10 years, it happens occasionally and, you know, you just work with it. But now there's times where you're on a telescope and you just see for 30 minutes satellites constantly passing over you because they're in this row or this constellation. And so it kind of ruins that whole image and that whole time on the telescope. And So there's ultimately becoming really two issues here, and that is, how do we preserve our nighttime sky for just us humans to go out and look at the stars, right? Mm-hmm. You know, imagine going out into the dark spots here we have in Australia and going up and looking for a nice meteor shower or something like that, but you just see artificial human stuff that we put up there. And then at the same time, we start limiting our ability to do ground-based observing, ground-based astronomy. And there's a real worry that we could actually, that the entire industry could be essentially killed, not just optical astronomy here as well, but yeah. radio astronomy, something this country is built on, because you have giant Wi-Fi routers above you.
Are there laws surrounding satellites and how many can be in space at once?
Yeah, so this is kind of where this is where the trick is, because a lot of the laws are just outdated, and this is not being mean here. The laws were written in space for a world in the 1960s, early 1970s, which is not the world of today. And, you know, most of the way it's governed is the UN Office for Outer Space Affairs manages what happens in space, the laws around it, and who can put what. And essentially, there's a giant database that says, hey, you know, these satellites are going up in this path, so you avoid collisions, and kind of like traffic management.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that works. And what they do is they say, okay, in order for you to kind of get an approved orbit, approved path, the country that's responsible for the launch, not the company or the person, the country from which it is launched from, so in this case, the U.S., as long as they have their internal processes that they can guarantee that company is safe and essentially doing the right thing, that's okay. Now, the U.S. essentially just says, all right, you obey the simple laws. You're not going to crash into another satellite. You've tried to mitigate your satellite breaking apart and creating space debris. And as long as you're going to obey the federal communication rules, you know, kind of the FCC, all the other rules that govern television and radio, that's it. No one actually says, when is it too much? How are you doing to limit your light pollution? What are you doing to limit your obstruction of views? What are you doing to limit your interference with ground-based things? It's all about kind of limiting crashes in space. But that's it. And now that this issue is becoming a reality, that there are a lot of satellites becoming up there, you know, currently there's about 4,500 active satellites. There's probably about 9,000 satellites total. A lot of them are defunct. So trying to say you're going to get to 40,000 is a really big jump in the amount of satellites that you're putting up there.
Now, also scientists have created a new technique for finding oxygen in the atmosphere of other planets to help search for life. Can you tell me a little about that?
Yeah, you know, obviously one of the big quests is to find life anywhere. And, you know, there's a lot of work on trying to find simple life in our solar system. But people ultimately want to know, is there complex life? Maybe not intelligent life, but at least complex life in all these planets we find around other stars. We're finding lots of planets orbiting around other stars. Do they host life? And so one of the big markers for life is oxygen. We breathe it in, plants breathe it out. You know, it's a big part of what we call biosignatures, the life cycle of a living planet. Now, in the past, it's been really hard to find oxygen. It's all of the elements actually have their own signature. So it's kind of like a fingerprint. And if you can find that fingerprint, you can actually find that element. Now, the fingerprint of oxygen is really hard to find relative to, say, hydrogen or helium. And it also takes a really big telescope. And so a lot of work has not gone into finding oxygen in these planets, except some astronomers now figured out there's a new way that when oxygen molecules crash into each other, and this happens all the time, it kind of produces a spark in the infrared, this kind of, again, night vision. And if you look for these sparks, you can actually detect oxygen directly in planets around really distant stars and then directly see there could be a living habitat or a living biosphere on that planet using this technique.
Now, Brad, the American Astronomical Society has been meeting in Hawaii this week, and I understand there have been some big announcements so far, including when NASA's Hubble replacement, the James Webb Space Telescope, will be launched.
Yeah, so, you know, every year there's kind of this annual meeting, and they call it the Super Bowl of Astronomy. And a lot of international people go, you know, I'm not there this year, but generally people will go there. There's something like 3,500 astronomers. It's pretty mostly everyone in this field there. And so lots of big announcements are happening. And of course, one of the biggest questions has been, what is the status of not only Hubble, since this is the 30th anniversary of the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope? It's kind of remarkable. But when is the new successor going to go up? You know, and we talked about this last week, that this is kind of something to look forward to this decade, this new James Webb Space Telescope going up. Now, it has been delayed for a number of years. It's had a huge cost overrun, and most notably in about late 2018, when it was getting ready for a launch supposedly last year, they said, no, we need to fix some things and won't be launched until 2021. And so they've now announced that it is still on track. Most of the issues they think that they've encountered are solved. They're well into the final testing and getting ready for launch. And it's still ready to be launched sometime in March 2020, which will be quite exciting to see it actually go up and start doing cool science. To put it in a scale, the Hubble Space Telescope is 2.4 meters. The James Webb Space Telescope is 6.5 meters. So it's actually 20 times more powerful than the Hubble Space Telescope. And not only is looking at different colors in the Hubble Space Telescope, but then fainter light. And it's kind of cool because no one thought the two telescopes would actually be operational at the same time. James Webb purely was built as the successor to the Hubble, thinking that the Hubble Space Telescope would eventually die, and then we'd launch James Webb.
Yeah.
And even with the delays of James Webb, Hubble's going so well still, we probably will see both telescopes in orbit at the same time, which kind of, you know, double your fun, so to speak, in our terms, which would be quite remarkable.
Brad, scientists have found the earliest evidence of the cosmic dawn, known as the first stars.
So, yeah, we have the cosmic dawn, and we also have what's called the cosmic dark ages. We really like our words here in astronomy. Well, Big Bang happens, and then we create stuff, and we create hydrogen and helium. Those are the simplest things to form. But it actually takes time for that hydrogen and helium to come together to actually form stars and then planets and stuff. It takes time to form this stuff. And so there's a period after what we call the cosmic microwave background, which is kind of the relic light of the Big Bang, until what we get to the first stars. And this is because there's just nothing there to shine light. Stuff hasn't really been made in order to create light that we can then see traveling through the universe. So trying to find the period of when the first stars and therefore the first planets and therefore the first galaxies come together has been a big quest in astronomy. And so announced that at this meeting in Hawaii, they think that they found three bubbles, they're calling it, three areas of galaxies that have essentially come together to be shined right after those first stars have been formed. So it's kind of like, you know, you're traveling through the smoke or the fog and all of a sudden your headlights come on and you kind of see where the car is. Well, that's what they think is. They're actually now seeing where this boundary is when these first stars and literally the first stuff in the universe was created.
And did they know where to look before?
Kinda. I mean, ultimately far away. Because the trick here is because it's so far away, we're talking about 13.5 billion light years away. So something really far away. You have to look in different colors of light. So as light travels through space, it actually stretches. This is what we call the Doppler effect. So it's kind of like if you're standing on a road and you hear a police car and you kind of get that pitch going. Well, light does the same thing. And so as light changes or stretches, it goes from the colors we can see with our eyes to infrared, to far infrared, and then into things like radio or microwaves. So it's actually kind of hard to see. So what you have to do, it's kind of like tuning in a radio frequency, is you change the dial of colors, hoping to find where this exact period is. So they created very specific ways of looking at different bands of colors of light, kind of like tuning the radio and looking for when this light popped out, when they got a kind of a signal. And one of the things they designed popped out this signal of these three big galaxies. And the areas are about 1 million light years across. So to put that in a scale, our galaxy is 100,000 light years across. So it's kind of like 10 times the size of our Milky Way that they found 13.4 billion light years away.
You're listening to Nightlife. Laura Chilingirian here with you with ANU astrophysicist Dr. Brad Tucker talking space and technology. And Brad, what is happening to the length of a day on the planet Venus?
it's changing. Now, this
every
is good
day?
For us. So this is the trick. It's kind of one of these things. You think we would just know how long a day is on Venus, but it's been a source of issue for 30 years. So when one of the first probes was launched to Venus, the messenger craft, as it went to Mercury, one of the goals was to measure the length of a Venus day. Now, the Venetian day is interesting because it rotates so slowly, it's almost on the same time as its orbit around the sun. So it's almost like a day is the same length as a year. Not quite, but similar. Mm-hmm. And so scientists kind of know that the day is about 243 Earth days. So literally one day lasts for 243 Earth days. So it's a very long day. But to try and, you know, kind of get it precise down to the minute and hopefully the second, it's been a bit of a trick. So now in the past 30 years, people have found that the day length has actually varied by 6 to 10 minutes. So it's actually a fairly big time difference that this planet's rotating. And one of the reasons why is if it only rotates every 243 days, you have to observe it for years just to see a few spins. And now what appears happening is what we think is the day on Venus actually does change, partially because there's so much atmosphere. The atmosphere of Venus is so thick that it kind of produces a little bit of a drag, kind of like air resistance. And as the planet slowly spins, this little bit of drag slows down the actual spinning of the planet, therefore changing its day. And so if you were to be on Venus one workday, it would always be constantly changing, and one Monday would go on forever.
How many years have scientists been looking at this to be able to measure this? Because if it's 243 Earth days, I imagine they've been looking at this for a little while.
Yeah. So the messenger spacecraft only looked at it for about a couple years. And then people realized, well, we've been observing the planet from Earth and from telescopes here on Earth for decades. So they kind of took all of the images we've had of Venus and put them together, essentially, to get a span of about 30 years, which is only about, you know, 40 days, which doesn't sound that long. Mm. And so they did this to actually figuring out, you know, how does it change? And what they found is it does appear to be every cycle has a slightly different speed relative to where they're measuring. And so it's kind of an interesting thing. We know a lot about planets and we look at a lot about planets, but sometimes these fundamental measurements are actually really hard to do because our planet, maybe things act differently. And Mars is so similar to Earth, it's easy to figure out these things on Mars. But Mercury and Venus, they're very different. And so measuring these fundamental measurements of time and day, which then affects what we know about exoplanets and how they spin and the life that can exist on them, is actually more complicated than it seems.
And learn something new every day with you, Brad Tucker. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And I'm glad this chat was not on Venus.
Nightlife on ABC Radio.